So this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
Hitting record too. I did hit record. I hit it.
Aw, damn. All right. Quick, shit. Welcome to Feature Creep, colon.
Built-in microwave, semicolon.
Okay, really quick. I'm Ned. You're Meg.
Yeah.
Yep. This is our podcast. And email us. Email Dana, D-A-N-A at fcbm.io. She knows what's up. She founded the whole thing. It's all her fault.
Yep.
And she'd love to hear from you. And we would too. But if you email Dana, she'll forward it on to us after filtering out the garbage.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, front matter stuff. Check.
Check. Done. Okay.
Title and names. Check.
We've self-promoted our podcast on our podcast. Good job, Goatee.
Right. Yes. Whee! We're talking about Dita Roms today.
Yes, Dita Roms. Dieter?
Something
Dieter?
That's actually directly in the vein of art and design.
Yes. Our podcast that is ostensibly about art and design will be about design today and possibly some art. We'll see.
Yes. So the impetus for this particular subject matter came from a video that Ned sent me a week or two ago where Dieter Roms is wandering out. Was it a museum? It looked like a museum, right?
Yeah. Like it's like a design museum and it's just got a bunch of like furniture up on racks that are like you can see it. And I don't know if it's, I don't actually know that much about it. I probably should, especially for this podcast. But if you Google it, you can just look up Dieter Roms points at things. And
yes, points at things.
Yeah, it's a video from May 4th, 2020. And it's Dieter Roms pointing at things he doesn't like. And it's really
it's delightful.
Yeah.
And like he wanders around. He uses a cane to walk with, and he picks the cane up and points at things.
Yeah.
And then like reacts to the thing that he's pointing at.
Some
most
commentary.
Of which he. Yeah.
It's like it's criticism, and it's thoughtful and considered, and it's not. It's great because there's this one scene where he just points and then shrugs a little bit. And then he really gets into the shrug a second time because he doesn't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, it's like a tiny shrug, and then he looks back at it, and then he looks in it like a huge shrug. Like his elbows go all the way up to the level of his shoulders and back down again.
Yeah,
like, I don't know.
It's fantastic.
And he says, I don't know.
Right. It's like, I don't know. So before we get too far into that, let's just give some background. Who the fuck is this guy? So he was born... Dieter Roms was born the 20th of May, 1932. He is still alive, and so he'll be at the end of this month. Or no, he just turned 92, right? At the end of May. So he'll turn 93 in a month.
Yep. Happy birthday, Dieter Roms.
Yeah.
And he was born in Wiesbaden, Germany.
Yes.
So he's got a great German accent.
Yep.
When he speaks in English, he has a German accent.
Yeah, he started studying architecture and interior decoration at the Wiesbaden School of Art, now part of the Rhein-Main University of Applied Sciences. And so he studied architecture and interior decoration in 1947.
Nice.
Yeah.
He says this article that I found from Witso. VITSOE.com describes him as an industrial designer, which means he designs like objects for your house, like chairs and coffee pots and bookshelves and things like that, right?
Yeah.
It says here he was strongly influenced by the presence of his grandfather, who was a carpenter. And he worked in carpentry too. He earned awards for his carpentry, and then that's how he ended up becoming an architect. And I think he did that in the 1950s. And he started working for Braun, which is like coffee maker company, right? Mm-hmm. In 1955. That's what I got here. And he also became a protege of the Ulm School of Design, which descended from Bauhaus. And he became, at that point, he became like involved in product design. So they say, like, famously, what he did was add the clear Perspex lid to the SK4 radiogram, which yes. he designed in 1956. So what is that?
So what is that? So it is it's a radio phonograph.
Okay.
It's actually quite beautiful. It's definitely worth looking up. If you look up the Braun SK4 radiogram, it's worth looking at. It's like the size of a bread box, maybe a little bit bigger.
Yep.
And it's got a place to play records, and it has a radio, and it's got speakers on the front, and it's got a hinged lid. And so I guess his sort of influence of adding that hinged lid was notable.
The Museum of Modern Art says it was nicknamed Snow White's coffin because of the white metal casing, and then its transparent lid, which is really funny to me. Let's see, what else does the MoMA say about it? It's like an iconic design at this point. Like,
yep, yeah.
And it says the product has an elemental look that redefined the typology of domestic audio equipment. Very compact, simple designs secured bronze success in post-war consumer electronics market and became a model for their many competitors. So, like, I guess you could say that since they mentioned post-war, like, Dieter Rams, basically, his aesthetic became what Braun was known for.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Cool. Very cool.
Yeah. So given that, what we want to look at here is that, so I wanted to clear some things up. Industrial designer means usually manufacture or designing products for the explicit purpose of mass production.
Aha. Okay.
So the idea is, and you're not wrong. It's like, yeah, like home goods, like things that everyone might want to buy. So
durable objects
like,
yeah.
And Braun actually was a German consumer products company founded in 1921. So Dieter Rams was recruited at the age of 23 in 1955. He was recruited by Braun as an architect and interior designer. So they recruited him to help them with their industrial product design, basically.
Got it.
I think just for the purposes of, like, you know, we could get lost in his entire life, but maybe we should kind of focus on, we could talk about, so he has introduced the idea of, I love that start. He created something called the 10 Principles of Design.
Yeah.
And we can kind of go through those, but I also love the start of this, which is we're reading from the Dieter Rams Wikipedia article to support our discussion. And
I also have an article from designmuseum.org about his 10 principles specifically.
Right. Yeah. So so we will reference both of those, but I just want to point out that the first sentence in the 10 Principles of Good Design segment in the Wikipedia article says Rams introduced the idea of of sustainable development and of obsolescence being a crime in design in the 1970s. Yes.
Oh my God. Yes. He's very much opposed to like throwaway shit, like disposable culture.
Right.
He produced and oversaw 500 products as chief of design of his 40-year career at Braun. Wow. That's so influential.
Yeah.
Holy crap. That's a lot of stuff. And all of it meant to be like used and relied upon for extended periods of time and not like thrown away. That's really cool. He said that, and this is from designmuseum.org, he strived to be environmentally friendly before it was popular and believed that design can and must maintain its contribution toward protecting and sustaining the environment. He was like ahead of his time, the fact that he was thinking about that stuff. Meanwhile, everybody's stuffing asbestos into their houses.
Right.
Which, side note, we had solar installed on our house, and it's beautiful, and it's done. And when they were up in the crawl space running the wiring for it, something happened. It's not their fault. It's the fault of whoever built this house and then retrofitted it in interior. Something happened in the crawl space. And when I went to open our back hall closet the other day, yesterday, I opened it and a shitload of asbestos rained down all over me. So I am now trying really hard not to think about how I'm going to be dead from that in 10 years, painfully. Anyway, bad design. Bad design right there.
Yeah.
Not what we want to talk about today. So yeah, like here he has like they have the 10-point list here. Do we want to like read the whole thing or go one by one?
I think we could just kind of go by one by one. I guess we could kind of crib it really quick. And just kind of go through all 10 of them really quick, and then we can go back and talk about them. That way, if people want to stop listening, they can at least have got the 10.
Yeah. I mean, the Design Museum asks what is good design, and their answer to the question of what is good design is to quote Dieter Rams, right? So
right.
Like it, and this is because they're asking what is the good, they're asking an ethical question here. So this is about design ethics for what it's worth.
Right.
And he says, Dieter Rams pressed for a less is better or less but better approach. So like use better materials, make better designs, and try to keep it really elegant and like simple. And I remember in the video that you sent to me too, he talks about how like to reiterate what you said about design, bad design being a crime, talks about how like bad design is offensive on two fronts. One, because it stands in its own as a bad design. Bad design is bad,
yes,
right? Like
right.
It's not helpful. It doesn't suit the intended purpose. It doesn't solve a problem, whatever the case may be, right? But bad design is a choice that also rules out the possibility of better or good design.
Yep.
And so you're not just making something that's not as good as it could be. You're also eliminating the possibility that you will have a good design when you opt to design something poorly. And so it's a compounding problem.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Which I really appreciate. Like that's,
No, it's great. And I think that's going to come through when we go through the, let's just quickly list off the 10.
Sure.
And then we can kind of go back and because I think they're sort of self-informing as well. You know, it's like nice to get the whole picture. So so number one is innovative. So the idea is that the 10 principles of good design, right? So the principle number one is about innovation or being innovative. Number two is makes a product useful. Number three is aesthetic. Number four,
it's nice to look at.
Yeah. Number four makes a product understandable. Number
five
is unobtrusive. Number six, it is honest. Number seven is long lasting. Number eight is thorough down to the last detail. Number nine is environmentally friendly. And 10 is a little design, is as little design as possible. So, so we could kind of start at the top, which is the idea of innovation or innovative. And Wikipedia says, in terms of entry number one, for innovative, the possibilities for progression are not by any means exhausted. Technological development is always offering new opportunities for original designs. But imaginative design always develops in tandem with improving technology and can never be an end in itself.
Mm. That warms my heart.
Yeah. I also think like this is kind of a positive take on the idea of like don't fucking reinvent the wheel, like just use like, you know, innovate, but don't just make more of that. Like don't, well, we'll get into that. Like, you know, when he talks about being, when he talks about it being, it needs to be honest, right? Like if you're representing something as new and innovative when it's not, that's not really honesty.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, an innovation doesn't have to be like crazy, but there's interesting products. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with, if you're of a certain age, you grew up with can openers that were very different than the ones you can buy now.
Yes.
There was an innovation in the technology for opening cans, and the way that the lid is separated from the can has changed radically.
Yes.
And it's created a much better product. And that's a very good example of like innovation in my, from my point of view.
Yep. Yep. Improves upon something.
Yep.
Number two, making a product useful. This is something for me that like runs through sort of design principles, regardless of what you're designing for. Like, design should follow the necessity that you're problem solving for, right? Because if you don't have like a purpose for the design, then where do you even start, right? What do you have to know what you're designing for in order to make a design that solves a problem or serves the purpose of the design.
Right.
So it seems to me that one follows the other, right? Like, in order to know what that design ought to be like and whether it's good, you have to know what you're making it for.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because I think like I've over the years I've heard from or read about a lot of people who seem to put the horse before the cart before the horse, where they're like, I want to be an entrepreneur, or want to be like a designer, or I want to like invent something.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, but how do you know you want to do that when you're not like identifying a thing for which you need to design or solve or innovate? Like,
yes.
What? How did you even arrive at this conclusion? So like, yeah, good design makes a product useful. Like, this is why I think, for example, the MacBook Air is so useful. It's like, it does the trick. It creates a portable laptop computer that's so lightweight. Like, when I first bought my MacBook Pro, years ago, it was the first time I had bought a laptop, and I bought it with student loan money. And so like, it didn't really matter how much it cost. And I got this really fabulous MacBook Pro, but I got the 17-inch one, and oh my God, hauling that thing around, I was like, this is not actually like a portable object. You basically need like a wagon to drag it behind you. It's so fucking heavy, and it doesn't fit in a standard backpack. So like, what problem is this solving for? Because it's not portability.
Yep.
And if you can't move it around, it's not very good as a desktop computer either. I would get a way bigger monitor then.
Right.
So it was like, I don't know. It just was, it struck me as I paid $2,000 for this like immaculate equipment. Like, this doesn't really solve the problem that got me buying a laptop in the first place, which was I need a computer that can come with me at all times.
Right.
And I like at that point decided the next time that I bought a computer, and I've purchased a lot, it turns out, a lot of Macs since then, Mac laptops, because I destroy them quickly.
Hmm.
So durability is another thing that I need to solve for. And so far, it hasn't really worked with these laptops. But I resigned at that point to buying 15-inch or 13-inch. And I had a 13-inch MacBook Air that was actually great. It was very portable. I could carry it in one hand without risking injuring my fingers or wrist or dropping it. And it was great. And then I spilled a whole glass of water on it and just fried the keyboard. And it still started up just fine, but I couldn't do anything with the mouse pad or the keyboard. It's still in the house. Damon's like, I'll replace the keyboard. And I'm like, that's never happening, but whatever. I have another one that I'm using now, and it's an older one that I bought that's refurbished. And I'm back to the very heavy, clunky 15-inch. It's got the beautiful screen on it, but it's like, I can barely pick it up with one hand.
Mm-hmm.
Without like injuring myself or dropping it.
Right.
So it's really interesting that like even within the same company, the designs vary so much that their utility is variable as well. And if ostensibly they're trying to solve basically the same problems with these various computers. Anyway.
Well, I mean, this is where, you know, like we've talked about this before, where capitalism butts up against and ruins everything, right? Because the problem is the problem they're trying to solve is how to make as much money as possible.
Yes.
That's the decision maker. That's it. That's all that matters. All this other stuff is like, you know, there's money to be made if you can get a bunch of people to agree that your product meets the 10 designs of good or the 10 principles of good design within, but only in the sense,
but only if it makes money doing so.
Only in this, only in the sense that it brings attention to you and is advertising for your product, which is what you want to sell. And somehow along the lines, you figured out how to make a product that's like, you know, I mean, there's all these approaches, right? Like those loss leader ideas where it's like, oh, we're going to make, you know, one product, like our flagship product, where even though it costs like a consumer $1,000, we're still actually kind of taking a bath on it, but that limits how many actually get sold. And then everybody's like, oh, look, everybody's buying that fucking sweet ass toaster. Oh, fuck. Mm-hmm. I can't actually afford that, but I can get one of their other models that's pieces of shit. Like, you know what I mean? Or like, yeah. So, anyway, it's complicated. But would you say we should talk about how a product is useful?
Yeah. I mean, like your comment about the can opener. Yeah. Like, if using a can opener results in the frequent injury of your hands by cutting them with jagged metal, then it's not a good design because it's not useful.
Right.
Like, and like can openers work in two different directions. Like some of them cut vertically down into the lid and some of them cut around the body of the can so that the lid comes off and it's not like a jagged, sharp cut. I think that's what you were referring to when you talked about
That's the new
innovation in the utility.
Historically speaking, fairly recent. I mean, they've been around probably for the last 20 years now or something, but basically I can't remember who.
There's also the electric can openers, which to me are a terrible design unless you have the type of physical impairment or an issue where operating a hand crank can opener doesn't work for you, because now you have electrified an object that doesn't, strictly speaking, require electrification to work. And so if the electricity goes out, your entire can opener ceases to work now. So now you've got like a probable failure in this object that's designed to run off of electricity, where either the power goes out or something goes wrong with the can opener itself and it no longer functions because something electrical in it goes awry. And now your whole product is useless, right? And like the electrification of it just seems like unnecessary complexity. Again, with the caveat that some people need the assistive device aspect of an electrified can opener. But the good design number 10, good design is as little design as possible. For me, the electric can opener violates that principle.
Right, right.
Unless it's assistive technology, in which case you can't help it.
Right. So there's the new style of can opener that I'm talking about emerged in the 1980s. There's no reference to who invented it, as far as I can tell. But I'm also looking at the Wikipedia article on can openers. But it does mention, and this is the thing that I wanted to call out. So that rotating wheel style that used to push down into the can and create that jagged edge. Or it was oftentimes relatively smooth compared to the like puncture and move style. I don't know if you've ever used if you've ever used the can opener on a Swiss Army knife, for instance, the way that works is it sort of levers it's a lever that hooks onto the rim and then it dips the knife down in, like there's a little sharp piece and it sort of cuts a little segment and then you move it forward and cut a new segment and you kind of go around and that leaves a very jagged edge.
Yes.
then there was like kind of the wheel cutter style, which left a fairly smooth cut, but still very sharp. And then in the 1980s, a new one emerged, which actually cuts the outside seam of the can. And the way that it cuts it leaves it rolled over in a way that leaves it relatively safe.
Yep. And you're not going to accidentally get a laceration if you touch it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so those can opener styles are much more like, I think it's hard to find can openers that don't work that way. There's still some old classics. But
I have an OXO one or OXO. I don't know how the company prefers it to be pronounced, if it's OXO or OXO, but
yeah.
I have one and it has the little, crank part of it that you rotate with your hand while you're squeezing the can opener against the can with your other hand. The crank part is very large, so for people who have arthritis or problems grasping things with their fingers, it just makes it easy for normal people like me who don't have impairment in their hands to get it open really quickly too. It's like easier to handle, which I appreciate.
Right.
Yeah. My right hand used to not work so well from like nerve damage, but it's recovered for the most part. But I still appreciate that can opener.
Right. Right.
Yeah. The utility of a product is like, for me, that's like a really important, like of all 10 of these principles, I feel like if number 2 fails, if a product is not useful, the other 9 might as well.
Yeah. Right.
It's just totally irrelevant whether it's beautiful or not. If it doesn't work, then what the fuck? Right.
Right. So like aesthetic is funny to me because I guess the reason he used aesthetic rather than like a product is beautiful, because beautiful is subjective, right?
Yeah.
And aesthetic is less subjective. Like, it's definitely something you could argue for, but I think the idea of aesthetic is basically a broader sense, like the philosophy of art, right? Like, or the sort of like I guess like a more formalized version of beauty, right? Where it's like,
yeah,
like something might not be beautiful to you, but we can discover and outline its aesthetic and then see that it is beautiful within that aesthetic.
If yeah. That makes sense. Like, for sure. Yeah. The experience you have interacting with the thing should be positive.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And like take for example, his, Dieter Rams's, record player that we were talking about a minute ago.
Yep.
Like, it's one of the things that's so great about it is that it's so nice to look at. And when you touch it and interact with it physically, it's pleasing. You know, it's not made out of rusty metal,
right?
For example, which would be an unpleasant experience to handle and touch and have sitting in your house or whatever. So I think it aesthetic has a lot to do with the sensory experience of interacting with the thing that is designed.
Okay.
The design object.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not just strictly like, you know, aesthetics in art is this 10 principles is about what is good in design, right? The ethics of the design.
Yeah.
In aesthetics, what is beautiful is important in art, right? Like beauty and aesthetics is the question of what is the beautiful as opposed to what is the good.
Right. Right.
And it's both of them are subjective, I think. Although ethics might be less subjective than beauty.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's certainly probably more consensus around some of that, but these days maybe not.
Before we started recording, we were talking about aesthetics essentially, because when you sent that video to me of Dieter Rams, and then I looked into like his design and stuff and the fact that he worked for Braun, a lot of his design for me made me think of Mark Newsom, who was a designer for Apple. And I wondered, does Mark Newsom consider Dieter Rams an inspiration in terms of Mark Newsom's design, because there's very similar aesthetics between the two of them And I was aware of who Dieter Rams is, but I didn't ever really deeply consider his designs. I have considered Mark Newsom's designs before. And so for me, when I looked at Dieter Rams' designs, I thought, oh, Mark Newsom. But obviously
sure.
Dieter Rams came first, so it would be Mark Newsom like evolving from Dieter Rams rather than the other way around. It just so happens that I knew about Mark Newsom before Dieter Rams. But I think that a lot of Mark Newsom's designs agree with or follow or adhere to the Dieter Rams' 10 principles of good design.
Yeah. I think we may have to revisit that video after this and watch it. I think there's a Mark Newsom designed piece of furniture that Dieter
that he doesn't like.
Yeah, I think so.
But
I don't know. That may have to be bonus round at the end.
Yeah, we'll have to look at that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to makes a product understandable. So it clarifies, right? It clarifies the product structure. Better still, it can make the product clearly express its function by making use of the user's intuition. At best, it's self-explanatory. This is like the golden, like fucking nailed it if you can get this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you have no idea what we're talking about, I can imagine, you know, there's some things we can kind of like, for instance, we can talk about stuff that probably most people understand, like a chair. So if you keep something looking a lot like a chair, that is a kind of, you know, you might want to try and create some strange chairs, right, that don't look like chairs for lots of reasons. And I'm not trying to dissuade you from that. But for the purpose of this argument, if it looks chair-like, then it's going to give a lot of people, you're playing into the idea that you can sit on this because it's a fairly broadly accepted article of, you know, material good that lots of people are familiar with. And so if you have some object you're designing and there's a place to sit, the more you can make it look like a chair, the more obvious it will be that someone should sit there. Right. So I think that's kind of the idea, is like, use design language in order to capture and make use of people's existing bias, right? Like, but in a good way, like in a positive way, like use it to help explain what the fuck's going on with this object.
Yeah, like this makes me think, if you design an object that looks like a chair that is not meant to be sat on, is it a chair or what is it? Like,
I mean,
or even more specific, if you design a chair that is not meant to be sat on, is it a chair?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but it's definitely
weird.
I mean, like most things, design principles, like the 10 principles of good design, the 10 principles of good design, like just knowing about them and then making purposeful, you know, breaking these rules purposefully is its own reward for sure. If you're like, no, the whole point of this is to create an object that is uncomfortable to look at or uncomfortable to interact with. Like there's lots of, you know,
hostile architecture.
Yeah. So, but the making a product understandable is like leaning into things that we already know about. You know, like people use typewriters for a long time, so there's a reason keyboards kind of continue to be arranged and look the way they do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like that's, you know, and it exists everywhere, right?
So like, you know, when you get IKEA furniture and you take it home and they have the instructions that don't have any language, just the pictures of you putting it together?
Yes.
Or the illustrations, I guess, of like how to assemble it. Would you say that in some ways that the finished design may be very clear how to use it, but the instructions for how to put it together are not necessarily understandable to some people? And so would the way that the instructions are designed fail on the count of making a product understandable?
I think I would spin that more positively to say that I think they do a pretty good job of like...
I do too. I've never had a problem following the instructions, but I know plenty of people who are like, curses. Yeah,
I guess
we'll have to go to bed and pick it up again tomorrow.
Without actually assigning any value to a negative or positive, I guess what I would say is that the existence of those instructions are like a subcategory of that product, right? So mm-hmm. there's the product that is assembled and then you live with. But part yep. of the product is this phase where you self-assemble it. And in within that is a product, which is a comic book that is without language.
Mm-hmm.
And that is designed to give you, their goal there is to make a product understandable with that. They're, you know, right. and they failed in that if there are people who look at that and they can't, they need help, right? But, yeah. you know, I mean, one could argue like, you know, lots of directions in that regard. But I think that that idea is this, right? That
yeah.
they're trying to follow this principle of making a product understandable by giving very clear illustration or trying to be very clear about illustration and assembly without mm-hmm. having to use language or, and that, you know, that in and of itself is, I think, a good example of following the 10 design principles, because it's also
sure.
trying to be as little as possible. It's trying to be thorough down to the last detail, but also yep. continuing to minimize like how much material it uses. Like you don't, it's not like you have a fucking novel. It's like they try to break down the steps into these discrete things and then keep everything, you know, on this like seems like newsprint or like highly recyclable, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. paper product. There's a lot to recommend or to sort of, you know, laud there, right? Like it's quite good.
Yeah.
Attempt in some ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, that making products understandable is tricky too, because there's sometimes you know, like when you're really kind of introducing a radically new kind of product that just doesn't really have an exist. It's not just an iteration, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, a totally new situation.
Like the iPhone was, or the, what you call it? The, not the iPhone, but the like little music player.
Oh, the iPod.
iPod.
Yes.
God, why couldn't I remember that?
I don't know.
It's funny too, because like there are some people, like I find the user interface and the design of Mac products, like the Mac computer and other Apple products, to some extent, very intuitive. So something about the way that I think just overlays seamlessly with the way these products are designed. But when I first got my Mac mm-hmm. and I switched from having to click the start bar on a fucking PC that was running a Windows operating system, going from the extreme necessity to overthink everything with the PC to the Macintosh, where everything was very like self-evident, mm-hmm. was a really hard transition for me. And I was constantly overthinking the Mac. And when I stopped doing that, it just started like, oh, I get it now. It's like very intuitive. But I've run into a number of people who are like, I can't get on board with Macs because I can't figure out where anything is or how to get to it or
right.
like how it operates. And it's kind of interesting. Like
I it's been a long time now since I transitioned from, I used to just have Windows everything.
Mm-hmm,
I do remember I kind of had a similar experience. I think also really? There were some things that I just kind of had to give up on. Like I was like, you know, that's just not part of my workflow anymore. And because Mac just didn't support whatever it was. I don't remember as much now. It had more to do with like file management and like folder management and things like that. And
yep.
like kind of previewing files and seeing like picture photo management and stuff, which you like, I remember people are like, oh, Macs are so good at it. I'm like, but they're not. Like, I mean, they're good.
Yeah.
I get why photographers use them. They're very stable. There's lots of, you know, it's very easy to kind of, you know, live in their ecosystem. But I remember at the time thinking, man, this is actually kind of garbage compared to the ability I have in the base operating system to manage my photo files. Like mm-hmm. Mac's approach is like, well, if you're managing photos, you should be using some premium software to manage it, not our interface.
Right.
And like, even now there's not, I can't remember. It's like kind of gone now, but there was even before they upgraded Mac, like the OS system at some point, and they did away with a kind of photo, like a folder preview setup that I really liked. Yep. Like it allowed me to see all the photos and then also like organize them and sort them or something. And somehow that there was some feature there that just went away, and they were like, oh, but you can do this. And I'm like, that's garbage. That requires me to like click every fucking photo or do, I don't remember what it was, but I was just like, you know, well, that part of my life is gone now. And I do remember, like, and it's kind of true, because there was a time when I was like really kind of into photography and I was starting to kind of get into it. And I think that just put a barrier up, and I was like, well, I don't have time to do this now. Like, I got other shit to do. And I never
I feel like on a long enough timeline, every piece of technology that I interact with reaches that point at some point.
Yep. Yep.
Where I'm like, this was great. And then you, because of capitalism, you arbitrarily changed a bunch of stuff for the sake of changing it. So you can be, you can violate the sixth design principle, which is that design, good design is honest. And you're like, oh, it's new. It's not new. You just randomly changed a bunch of shit. Like, Google loves to do this with Gmail.
Oh, it's the worst. Yeah.
It's so fucking annoying, because it's like, you actually haven't improved anything. You've just changed it so you can say that it's new and then make a bunch of money off of it.
Right.
It's so dumb.
Well, before we get to honest, let's go with number five, which is unobtrusive. So products fulfilling a purpose are like tools. They are neither decorative objects nor works of art. Their design should therefore be both neutral and restrained to leave room for the user's self-expression. I actually really love this. I think that this has that ring of like no false idols to it a little bit. Well, I just, you know, like, you look at all these objects. So Dieter Rams is like, you know, famous for being this like revolutionary designer, industrial designer, right? Like bringing these products that were just, you know, like copied by Apple, right? Like the design of it was copied by Apple, like, you know.
Yep.
But what I love about this particular one is it's a little bit like, no, these objects aren't to be worshipped. They're well thought out designed tools that people use.
They're not like a precious object that you should like encase and light up and leave alone and never use. They're meant to be used.
It's meant to be used. It's meant to augment your life. And it's meant to be unobtrusive. It's like, when you're not using it, it's out of the way and not getting in the fucking way of your life. Like, it's not drawing your attention over to it. It's not doing any of those things. I really like this, this concept. I think it's really great. And I think a lot of like products kind of miss that. Or I think what happens is like probably somebody tries to practice good design and then, you know, marketing comes along and they're like, okay, cool, but we need to put it in like hot pink and there needs to be like a display on it that calls your attention over to it. Like a bright blue LED. Those are popular right now.
Oh my God. On everything, to let you know it's on and working. And it's like, great, I get it. Can it not keep me awake at night?
Right.
Can it not pierce my eyeball and detach my retina?
I had these monitors that, fucking God, they pissed me off so much. There was just a bright blue LED down in the corner. So when you turned them on, it just went really bright and it was like hard to look at the monitor. There's just this bright blue LED shining at you the whole fucking time.
That's so infuriating. Yeah. So two things about this design principle. Two things came to mind. A good design is unobtrusive, number five.
Yep.
One, our PlayStation 5 fails at this entirely. It is the size of the dashboard of a car and looks like one too. It's huge. It's got wings on it like a fucking 57 Chevy. It's massive. It lights up. It makes noise. I didn't know where to put it. Like, I was like, where are we going to put this fucking thing? It's enormous.
It is.
Fails, right? Drives me crazy. And the whole reason is that what it was designed for, and we talked about this on a podcast a while ago when we first got this thing, what it was designed for is for show. It doesn't need to be that big to function.
Right. No, I mean,
it's that big because gamers stick it behind them on a shelf and you can see it in their like online streaming videos.
Yep.
That's why. It's a vanity object.
Yep.
Which is like violates the unobtrusiveness. Also, I was recently watching Josh Johnson on one of his stand-ups and he was talking about how an Uber or something came to pick him up the first time he rode in a Tesla car.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah.
And it pulled up. And when the Tesla is like in a particular mode, the door handles go flush with the body panels of the car. So you can't like access the door handle. They pop out and then you can lift the door handle to get open the door, get in the car. Right. So when it pulled up, he's sitting there like clawing at it like a little raccoon or something because he couldn't figure out how the door handles work to get in the car. And he was like, he said in his stand up, he's like, this is because I'm black, isn't it? Right. And then the door handle popped open and he was like, oh, never mind. It's just how the car works. But I remember getting a ride in our friend's car, the friend Tesla. And I was like, from the inside, I was confused about the door handle as well.
Yes. Yes.
And I remember my confusion and actually having to ask my friend who is the driver, like, how the fuck do I work the where is the door handle? It's so funny. So like, not only does the door handle problem, it doesn't make a product understandable. It is unobtrusive, but at the expense of making a product useful and understandable.
Like, well, do you know what's really funny about the Tesla door handles that confused me the first time I interacted with them was that I thought I was like, well, the first time I saw one, I was like, oh, this is clearly the place where I touch and then the door will automatically open.
Right.
Nope.
No.
Then a weird thing pops out that you kind of have to figure out how to, that I worry I'm about to break off as I try to open the door. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, it was just very
unsettling.
It just seemed like a miss to me. It was like, okay, cool. The aesthetic I get, right? So the idea is it's like, hey, we don't actually need door handles anymore. It's all automated, but we need to give you a design element that cues you in where you need to go to get the door open, right? It's like, it looks like a door handle has been painted on the side of the car. So I'm like, great. What if I just touch it and then the car opens?
And it pops, right.
But that's not what happens.
Nope.
And so then it's like, oh, I touch it, and then a complicated mechanism happens that I have to now operate in order to get the door open.
Right. And I learned just the other day, like apropos of nothing, completely unrelated to anything that we're talking about here now, I learned that those door handles can malfunction. And like, for example, somebody was in a wreck and the car started on fire. And because of that, the door, the mechanism for the door handle stopped working because the electricals were all messed up and somebody died in their car fire. Because they couldn't work the door handle because the door handle ceased to function because of the accident and the fire. And I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly what I'm saying about the probable failure, right? Like if you're designing something that only works when the electricals work and the electricals cease to work, your entire object ceases to work. And now you have this like whole design problem and somebody's dying in a fire. Like, that's crazy. Like, what? That's not as little design as possible. That's like overcomplicating the design. Why does it have to be electrified? Like, and then you have to balance these things against each other, right? Is the aesthetic gain that you accomplish by making them flush with the body and elegant looking, is that offset by the fact that like they don't actually work as intended in some cases? And so like, who gives a shit if it's aesthetic or not?
Right.
Yeah. Let's see. What's the next one? Oh, good design is honest. Number 6.
Yeah. So it does not make a product appear more innovative.
Yeah.
Innovative, whatever. It doesn't make a product appear more innovative. God damn it. Powerful or valuable than it really is. It does not attempt to manipulate the consumer with promises that cannot be kept. God damn it. Mm-hmm. Right. Like that's where I think, and look, I get that it's my personal opinion when we're going to talk about Tesla door handles, but I feel like they overpromised and underdelivered by a lot.
Yep. Yep.
Like it indicated to me that it was something it wasn't. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think the door handle one just like nails in the example of a couple of these, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that most product design is pretty dishonest these days.
I would agree. Like the ratio of badly designed dishonest products to good honest ones has increased significantly on the side of bad and dishonest.
Like, and it's kind of a bummer to me too, because like I think where this happens a lot is in the realm of sort of the cheaper versions of consumer, like the cheaper end of consumer goods. So like, you know, if we want to talk about like Android phones or iPhones, there's usually some flagship model. And then in iPhones, it's a little different because they don't actually, they make a cheaper version. And usually it's fairly, I think they still mostly kind of follow these 10 principles, right? Like they try to.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see how people create phones to capture that aesthetic without being able to deliver any of it. Like the number of phones that have fake lenses, because like the multiple lens thing is popular now, right?
Yes.
So the number of cheap end, like the low end phones that have like three or four dots that are just fake lenses,
is
maddening to me. It's like, so those don't do anything. It's just there to look like an iPhone. Or to look like it's more than it is. And this is where I think there's a sort of sad miss in that realm, because I think there's value in being honest about you being like a value proposition product. You're like, no, I only have the one fucking lens. But look, there's all this, like, from my point of view, I'm buying those anyway because I think it's absurd that I'm paying as much as I pay for a fucking desktop computer to put something in my pocket that I don't want to have in the first place.
Yes, but that's exactly how I feel.
But, you know, that said, I would much rather buy these, like, you know, you make a product that meets these 10 principles. Like a cell phone, and it's like, oh yeah, no, there's just a cheap camera on there, so there's just that one little dot and that's the camera. Great. Fucking awesome. I already hate the fucking, I didn't buy a phone because I needed, like, you know, a quality camera. I bought a phone because I need to have a fucking phone, and I'd much rather it was like smooth and like unobtrusive and got out of the way. And if you can do that because you're using cheap lenses anyway, fantastic. Yeah. I don't need it to fucking bump out on the top and show everybody I've got an amazing fucking expensive phone. I don't want that.
Right. The issue of cameras on phones for me is another like amplified problem, because it's like, okay, well, if you're going to put I'm not buying a phone because I need a camera. So me buying a phone and getting a camera is probably not going to provide me with the level of camera that I would want if I was just buying a camera,
right.
It degrades the camera experience to put a camera on the phone. Some exceptions may apply, and it also fucks up the phone to put a camera on it when all I need is a phone. Like it ruins two objects by smashing two of them into one, function of which is very good.
Right.
The phone compromises the camera, and the camera compromises the phone by making the phone $1,000.
Yes, it's so fucked.
I hate it. I hate it so much. Phones for me are an area of design that just like makes my rage go from 0 to 60 immediately. The current phone that I have, I spent $35 on because I was like, you know what phone I need? The cheapest fucking one available.
Right?
Because I'm not paying as much for a phone as a used car. Like, I'm certainly not leasing or leveraging debt to have a phone.
God, I know, right?
Oh, it's so infuriating. So, like, good design is honest. Yep. Good design is long lasting. See also how phones fail at that.
Right? I have, I have these two typewriters.
Yes.
I used to have one. Well, actually, I have several, but I have two mechanical. I have quite a few, but there's two. So I originally bought a mechanical typewriter, and it's an Olivetti Lettera 32, and that is a beautiful object that is a mechanical typewriter, and it works really well, and it's great for doing one thing, which is typing fucking letters, right? Or just typing shit.
Yep.
And so I forget where I was going with this. Oh, long lasting. So the one that I have, I think, was manufactured in the 50s, but I recently bought a Lettera 22 because I discovered that there was a 22 and they're very similar to the 32. And it's a little bit smaller, but it's actually it's a little more inferior in terms of its build quality. Like the 32 is like kind of been considered like one of the best versions of it. But I had to have the 22, and also right. It was on eBay and the price was right and I fucking got it. But that's beside the point. My point is these machines like still fucking work like, you know, 75 years later. The 22 actually might have been built in the 30s. I'll have to check. I haven't actually looked at it that much since I got it. It just came a couple of days ago. So
nice.
Yeah. And it's so I haven't looked up like the serial number yet to see like what year it was manufactured.
Type me a letter and send me a letter.
I will. I actually have some stuff I need to send you. So yeah. So but the point is like it, this is the problem, of course, with long lasting products is it's antithetical to proper capitalism in terms of like how you run a modern right. manufacturing company. Like,
yes,
you know, the problem with a company, the way the companies are set up is it's like you can't, you really fuck yourself if you create a product that once everybody buys one, you, there's no need to make the product anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem there is that the conversion of all things into consumable goods.
Yes.
Like there are things that will always be consumable or like in our current existence will continue to be consumable, which is like foods mostly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Foods, soaps, things like that, things that are just sort of, but even like soaps and things like that, it's less, you know, food, any kind of chemical reaction that humans require to process, right? Like non-reversible yeah. chemical reactions like food, you yep. know, like,
yeah.
But, yeah. And that's where the tragedy is it's like a lot of these things don't actually need to be, there's just no need for it. Like it, like a lot of the shit that exists that like is consumable,
like bottled water,
like bottled water. Yeah. Like,
plastic yeah. single use water bottles are one of the worst design yep. objects ever.
No, it's nuts. Ever.
They're horrible. They, yeah. it took something that was just fine the way it was, that was reusable, a cup, a mug, whatever, what have you, bottle, and turned it into something that only does bad things.
Right.
It's not durable. It's made out of toxic materials. It's not technically reusable. I mean, you can get more than one use out of a plastic water bottle, but eventually it's going to get smashed up and develop holes and leak, and then it doesn't even do the thing that it was designed to do anymore. Like, right. it just sucks. And they're not really recyclable. Recycling is kind of a lie.
No, so, like, no, not at all. I mean, that's the great tragedy, right? Is like, you know, there's yeah. actually two kinds of material that we use for liquid containers that are much more recyclable, and they aren't generally used. Like, I get why. Glass is not really a very valid object, right? And then aluminum mm-hmm. is difficult because they're still plastic lined.
Right, right.
It's a lot less plastic, but it's still plastic.
Yeah. So your typewriters are very durable and long lasting. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, it is.
And they really still cool. work the same and exact way that they did when they were first made all these years later. They're not any worse for wear.
No. Like, I mean, they have things that wore out on them that I've replaced. Like there's mm-hmm. a rubber platen, which is like the big rubber roller. I recently kind of panic bought a bunch of those to try and figure out what, like, because these are the things that like are harder to replace, right? But it yeah. turns out there's actually a company in the US that does resurfacing of them. So I'm going to send them off and have them resurfaced. But
oh my God, that's so cool.
Yeah, no, it is very cool.
Yeah, like, but, here's yeah. the other thing, right? The cottage industries that spring up around the maintenance of these durable objects is in some ways like analogous to and better than the like disposability, right? Like, rather than yeah. making it disposable, make it serviceable.
Yep.
And then you can keep making money off that thing. It's not just like a one and done.
Right.
Yep. And it doesn't have to be, oh, you have to buy 10,000 of it. Like paper plates right. or right. something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So number 8, good design is thorough down to the last detail.
So I actually really love this one because I think it's something you and I talk about a lot, which is the idea of like having a very considered life or like, or just, I feel like saying like we have a very considered life is not, I feel like that comes across as more like bigger than it is. There's lots of shit that I do that is stupid. I just try to be aware of it. Do you know what I mean?
You decide what's important to you, and then everything you do, not everything, but most things you do, you try to think, does this support the goal that I have of living this particular way or getting to this particular end result? Or like, does this fit in, or does this contradict or prevent me from doing the things that I've identified that I want to do?
Right. And there's considerations there. And sometimes you're just like, man, I just really wanted to do that today, even though it really kind of undermines a lot of the shit that I've been trying to do. Like, it doesn't make me like magically like, oh, I'm like some fucking successful person because I followed this one idea. It's just it's like this level of like self-examination where I'm like, oh yeah, no, I kind of try to look at that a little bit. And for me, like mostly, I think that applies mostly to my interpersonal relationships more than anything else. Like that seems to be where I spend a lot of my time and energy, is, you know, having interpersonal relationships, and I get joy from that. But I do notice sometimes I'm like, man, a lot of my other shit just kind of falls to the wayside because I'm prioritizing other stuff, which is, you know, the whole point of it is to self-examine and like, you know, how can I evaluate this? And is there a better way for me to like, you know, have my cake and eat it too? But
yeah. Like again with the designing to the detail, like that record player that Dieter Rams made with the clear lid and the thoughtful materials otherwise, and making it look nice, like just thinking on a bunch of levels at one time about the same object is important, especially if you're trying to make it like ethical, right? Like it can't just be by accident or not considered. You have to think in layers simultaneously in a lot of different directions. and like, I think that the 10 design principles that he lists here are in essence, like how to be thorough down to the last detail.
Yeah.
Like if you're thinking about these other things while you're designing the object, if you're thinking about all 10 of these principles, you're probably going to have an end result that is pretty thorough in and of itself.
Right.
That one's kind of self-explanatory, I think. And the design, the environmentally friendly design too. Like, don't make children's toys that they gnaw on out of lead.
Right. God, yes. Just this like consideration for the context of like what you're doing here.
Don't make ceiling insulation out of asbestos so that when there's a hole in the ceiling and you open a door, it falls on your face.
Yeah.
God damn it. Like when we had the asbestos tiles on the outside of our house removed, the city inspector came over to make sure that there wasn't like contamination in the yard, which there totally was because the people who removed our asbestos did a horseshit job of it. Yes. And they had to come back 3 times to clean it all up. And so this inspector is like, well, yeah. You know, I said the thing that this whole exercise in near futility has illustrated for me is what a terrible fucking idea it is to make objects like house siding tiles out of asbestos. And he's like, well, it is very durable. And I said, until it's not, when then it becomes poison.
Yes.
Like, that's really dumb. Really, really, really dumb, dude. He's like the city health inspector and he's trying to defend the utility of fucking asbestos tiles in the year 2024. And I'm like, no, that's not going to fly with me. Sorry. Right. No. The fact that you even have to be here is ridiculous. Yeah. Because we shouldn't be building things that people come into contact with every single day of their life out of shit that gives you cancer.
God, yes.
What are we doing? God. So yeah, good design is environmentally friendly. Plastic water bottles fail hard on design element number 9.
Yep.
Fail. And like the good design is this one, number 10, I think is a little bit more complicated. It's not as obvious as it seems. Good design is as little design as possible. Why should we design things with elegance in mind? Because using more materials than you need to is bad.
Right.
It's overconsumptive.
Yeah. Yep.
It also prevents those materials that you're overusing from being used for something else. this is another one of those things where it's like an amplified problem, right? Like if you're not being as conservative with the design as you could be and using as little design as possible, you're over designing by definition, and that's wasteful and eliminates other possibilities from coming to the fore, right?
Right.
Got to be careful about that. I think like when we were watching the video where he's pointing at Dieter Rams points at things, and he points at that like chest of drawers that's kind of like the drawers are arranged at these strange angles to each other on the bias. And he's just like, I don't get it. Like, I don't get why this is, why is this even designed this way? Like, it just seems weird for being weird's sake. It doesn't actually accomplish anything to make that design as obtrusive and weird and angular and take up as much room as it does. Like, okay, here's a perfect example, right? When you and I had to rent a car and drive across the country for many, many hours trapped inside that car, we ended up getting stuck with a BMW Mini Countryman. And this thing was so over-designed. What good did it do? It was, the interior of the car had so little usable space that like we couldn't barely fit the shit we needed for two people for like a couple of days inside of that vehicle because there wasn't any room. And yet for a Mini, it was gigantic.
It was giant. It felt, I feel like it felt as big as my truck.
It did. The inside of it felt as big. And yet it was horribly uncomfortable to drive and ride in.
Yeah.
You couldn't put a, like we had a tent, like a nylon camping tent that barely fit inside the car.
Yeah.
And there was no roof rack, so it had to go inside of the car. And in the dashboard, like, okay, remember in the original Wizard of Oz movie? Like, I don't know if there have been other movies. Well, there's the Wicked movie, but I'm talking about the old school one with the flying monkeys and Dorothy Gale and the red shoes and everything. Remember how the Wicked Witch has that, like, crystal ball she looks into, and it's, like, giant, and she stands over it, and it's, like, swirling with colors, and she's kind of, like, peering into it to see what's going on? That fucking thing was embedded in the dashboard of the car for no reason.
Yes, God, I know. It's so weird.
I don't know what that was. It was like constantly illuminated with LED lights like a fucking disco. And you're like, what is this thing? I don't even know. Like, what? I don't remember what its function even was. Why was that there? It took up the whole dash.
God, I don't know. It was stupid. I feel like it was like an oversized either speedometer or it was some kind of gauge that was like, just
yeah, it was supposed now to I give gotta, you some kind of look. Like information feedback loop, but
it was a Mini Cooper. What was it?
Countryman.
Countryman,
which is like the station wagon version of a Mini, which again, just like the camera on the phone and the phone on the camera. Why are these things being combined? Why would you take a car that is notorious for being tiny and turn it into a station wagon that serves none of the functionality of a station wagon and ruins the point of it being Mini?
Right. I'm looking at it now. It was so it was this like multifunction like speedometer display, and like I don't think like the new ones like have like a full LED screen there, but ours I think was just like the speedometer or something.
Yeah.
And it was just like this massive speedometer. And my favorite part was like, oh, there's somebody else who's fucking losing their mind over it. oh, it's like a video. Hold on. We don't need to watch the video right now.
Oh, my God.
But it's like, because like there's all these like arrows like pointing to shit. But basically it was like this giant speedometer in the middle of the dash, like where the radio would normally go.
Yes.
And it was like, you know, like a 12-inch plate. Like,
it was enormous.
And if I remember correctly, it had these multicolor LED trim.
Yep.
So you could dial in the color, the lighted color of the rim, the trim of that dial, as if that was helpful and useful in any way for driving to have LEDs that are bright and colorful around the thing that you really need to be looking at to get information from.
You know who that's good for? It's good for like a five-year-old. And guess what? Five-year-olds don't drive and they don't buy cars.
Yeah, they don't buy cars.
So what the fuck? Yes. What the fuck is this for? God. Who is this for? Also, if I'm driving and I need to look at the speedometer, why are you making me take my eyes off the road and off to the side of the steering wheel?
Right.
That's not a good place for that.
No, it's the worst. But like the Teslas did that too, right? Like the Model X or whatever had the centralized dashboard. Like a lot of cars do that because then it's cheaper for them to manufacture them because they don't have to move the dashboard assemblies. They just move the steering wheel.
Yeah. Yep.
But garbage from my point of view.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, as little design as possible, less but better, simple as possible, but not simpler. Good design elevates the essential functions of a product. So, yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, the devil's in the details in terms of applying this, but something to consider. And if you're kind of working on an art project, like a lot of these things could apply.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a fun exercise, you know, like what, you know, what are you making and why does it meet these things or doesn't, you know, interesting lens to look at the world through as well.
Yes. Yeah. I think this stuff, like it doesn't just, this is not only specific to design, like this whole, this type of thinking that gave rise to these 10 principles is good to apply broadly.
Yeah.
Like, it's not limited to design or art. I think it's really, really good.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, I would say probably we're at an hour and 10 minutes.
All right. Should we ask ChatGPT a strange question?
Yes, let's ask ChatGPT.
What does ChatGPT say about Dieter Rams?
Well, all right, so we're going to use the standard GPT-4.0 version. Let's ask it something specific about Dieter Rams. Let's say, okay, here's one. I'll start with, please review Dieter, how do you spell his name? D-I-E?
Yep, D-I-E-T-E-R.
Yep.
R-A-M-S.
10 design, 10 principles of good design. So, and then suggest a, so, let's see. So then let's think of a more modern product that we all interact with. Cell phones. So I'm going to basically ask ChatGPT to review the Dieter Rams 10 principles, and then I'm going to ask it to suggest modifications to what should we, like, you know, I guess, like, well, I'm thinking, like, toaster oven, toaster, blender, chair, household goods, right? Like what's like, let's see. So suggest modifications to a modern cell phone. How's that work?
Yeah.
That would help bring it
in line
with those 10 principles. Okay. So the prompt is, please review Dieter Rams' 10 principles of good design and then suggest modifications to a modern cell phone that would help bring it in line with those 10 principles.
Let's see
what it has to say. Ugh, so flowery. All right, I'll start at the top. Okay, so I'm going to skim over this. Like, if you're not familiar with ChatGPT, it's just a text completionist algorithm. But essentially it goes on to say, oh, Dieter Rams, a legendary industrial designer, laid out 10 principles of good design, and it correctly lists them in order, which we just did.
Oh, well, that's surprising.
Yep. Okay. So suggested modifications to modern cell phones to align with Rams' principles. So number one, reduce bloatware and UI clutter.
Mm.
Fucking A. Great.
Great.
Let's do it. Yeah. So it says why? To make the product more understandable, useful, and honest. Fantastic. How? Yes. How to do this? Ship phones with a minimalist OS interface and no pre-installed third-party apps, e.g. sponsored games, social media. Let users choose what's essential. Fantastic. Not a new idea by a long shot. A major complaint by most people for most computer products today.
Yep.
Okay. Simplify physical form. Why? To embody aesthetic, unobtrusive, and as little design as possible. How? Create a more uniform, symmetrical body with no unnecessary branding, fewer camera bumps, and flat edges that don't seek attention but feel solid and refined. Fuck yeah. Like, I was just talking about this. Like, don't give me fucking camera bumps that I don't need.
Yep. Yep.
Emphasize repairability and modularity. Why? To be long-lasting and environmentally friendly. How? Use screws instead of glue. Offer replaceable batteries and modular camera or storage components that users can upgrade without replacing the whole device. Fucking A. Like, you know, people have been asking for that for years now as that shit's phased away. Use sustainable materials thoughtfully. Why? To support environmentally friendly and honest design. How? Incorporate recycled aluminum, responsibly sourced glass, and biodegradable packaging. Be transparent about the life cycle and recyclability of materials. So I would argue that there's some social economic pressure for this.
Mm-hmm.
Like certainly companies are attempting to say that they're doing this.
Yeah.
So this one to me is like less, I don't find this particularly like, you know, innovative, but you know, I mean, obviously like it's important. It just doesn't surprise me. Right. So improve battery life over performance gimmicks. Why? To be useful, innovative in a meaningful way and long lasting. How? Prioritize energy efficiency and smart power management over chasing unnecessary high refresh rates or benchmark scores. This to me is fucking exactly what I want in a phone product.
Yeah.
Like I don't need to have like the phone this year. Like, you know, if I get a model this year, it's already like 10 times faster than like 3 years ago or something. So like, you know, don't chase that fucking high and just give me a phone that's like super power efficient.
Right.
Yeah. I don't actually need to watch like, it's also like pretty useless to me if I can watch like a 4K high def, like, you know, cinematic experience on my 2-inch or whatever, my 7-inch cell phone screen on an airplane when the battery's going to fucking die in like 6 hours by doing that. And that's pretty generous, right? Like, you know, probably more like 2 hours depending. But my point is that, you know, that's not to me, like you could just create products that probably 90% of people would be super stoked to have. A phone that the battery lasts like 3 days. That's not impossible.
God. No, it's not. I feel like I've had phones in the past, possibly the distant past, that lasted almost a week.
Oh yeah. Like my early cell phones, like the idea of like charging it every night was not something I thought about that much.
No. I literally
like,
plug mine in on the bed. Like
every fucking night. There's no cell phone you can not do that with. I mean, lately I've gotten lazy and I don't plug it in at night. And like today I'm at 24% and it's actually 5 PM. So like, that's pretty good. But, but also I don't use it that much.
Right.
Anyway, you know, I'm like at home, so I don't really need it other than like you fucking texted me earlier and you're like, I want a podcast. And I was joking.
I said, I said it like that too as I was typing it in. I was like, I want a podcast.
All right. So then it says, so improve battery life. Great. Okay. Number 6, streamline the camera UI. Why? To make it understandable and thorough down to the last detail. How? Present only essential controls in default mode. More complex options should be buried in advanced sections and not in the main screen. I feel like that's a thing that's already happening, generally.
Mm.
I am pretty happy with the camera application that I have on my Android Pixel fucking 6A or 7, or I don't fucking know what version it is.
Yeah.
This is like how little I give a fuck about.
Mine's like a Motorola.
I got a Pixel 6A. So,
okay.
Yeah. So like my camera app, I'm pretty happy with it. When it opens, there's a big white button that I press and it takes a photo right away. There's some basic zoom changes I can do pretty quickly without, you know, that's like available. And then there's like options that are kind of buried, right? That I can go find if I need to like make some like tweaks. And I find that once I've tweaked the settings the way I want, they stay that way. And I like that.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah. So like from my point of view, I feel like this exists and maybe there are cell phones that I'm not aware of that have a disaster of a fucking phone or a camera situation, but
my phone's cameras are pretty terrible. I mean, there's there's two lenses on mine, and if I want to take a photo of like one of the codes that hyperlinks to something that I need to look at, which are everywhere now, including on fucking restaurant menus, which is not an improvement,
right?
Oh, you can order from your server or you can order here at the table. Why do I need a $1,000 phone camera to make a menu item order when I'm already sitting inside the fucking restaurant and I could just tell you without having to involve expensive electronics? Right. And so like I have to basically like toggle between my camera's lenses if I want to take a photo up close or if I want to take a camera photo far away. It does not automatically make that determination for me, which is infuriating because inevitably the thing that I want to take a picture of is not the thing that the camera is set to at that time. So I'm constantly having to like negotiate with this thing. And then you're like, well, the moment's passed. Forget it.
Right. You know,
like, it's ridiculous. I don't even really ever like, I don't consider the cameras on my phone because they're so not useful that I've just kind of like forgotten the fact that they exist because they're so infuriating. Anyway, whatever. My phone is pretty durable though. I will say that. Mm-hmm. I've had it for a while now and I drop it all the time. Do you remember when you used to drop a phone and it was like, oh, my phone's dead now?
Yes. Yeah, I do remember that. That was difficult times for sure.
At least they've improved that.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. So number 7, it says ditch fake design tricks. Why? To remain obvious. So no faux materials, e.g. glass textured to look like leather, no artificial shutter sounds, no performance exaggerations in marketing. That seems, you know, like a no-brainer and stuff we've kind of complained about already. Offer a timeless mode UI theme. Why? To be aesthetic and long-lasting. How? A minimal grayscale or neutral tone UI theme with focus on readability and calm visual hierarchy. Think Braun calculator rather than Vegas slot machine. So this is where I think, just as a side note, I think it's telling and interesting to see how ChatGPT 4.0 works, which is that it's immediately calling back to... thematically, like somebody's mentioned the Braun calculator, and so that's like an association with Dieter Rams, as opposed to like something that might be more specifically useful to this argument, right? Like anyway,
sure.
But whatever. Okay. Design number 9: design accessories to match simplicity. Why? To keep the entire ecosystem thorough and unobtrusive. Matching color palettes. Clean cables, chargers without branding clutter, everything fitting together like it's from the same thoughtful vision. So this to me seems, you know, I mean, I absolutely understand why it would suggest this. I also just think like it's kind of meh. Like,
yeah.
I mean, actually, I guess like I'm just thinking about like the particular cell phones that I gravitate towards versus the ones I've seen marketed, right? So I am already gravitating towards ones that probably fit more of this design principle, right? Like I'm picking ones that have less branding, that have less ostentatious bullshit on them. Like, you know, there's a reason I went with the Pixel line eventually is because generally they come with less bloatware. Generally. Yep. They don't come with none. And one could argue most of the Google ecosystem is all considered bloatware now.
Bloatware at this point. Yeah.
But you know, in theory, so, and then number 10, eliminate the notch or punch hole if possible. Why? To pursue as little design possible and aesthetic clarity. move toward under display camera that don't distract from the device's purity of form. Let the display just be a display. So that's their, the front facing cameras, like somewhere along the line, they became, and I think I feel like this was a thing that, that Apple did at some point. Like they kind of had a little hole in the display. So the display, mm-hmm. like, wasn't sort of a uniform rectangle. Now it was like had a little dip in it where there was a camera. And like mine has, my phone has that as well. And the annoying thing about that is that, that originally the idea was like, yeah, the display goes up there, but really it's never going to make it look like a notch. It's just going to do like status information up there. But the reality is if I look at shit, it just fucking tries to use the whole display. And then there's a little black dot in the middle of it. Right. Yep. At the top. I'm just like, what's the point of that? Yeah. Anyway, whatever. yeah. Don't care. It's all yep. just garbage. Anyway. I don't know. So that's ChatGPT 4.0. Its idea of applying 10 principles of good design to cell phones. So there you
I'm it wasn't terrible.
No, no. I mean it's, you know,
it was more
it's
coherent than I thought it would
be. Yeah, I mean, I get so I work with these large language models in various capacities, both at my full-time job and then also some contract jobs that I've taken. And the funny thing is, like, when I've been designing products or working on products that integrate these various large language models, there's one particular, I think it's Microsoft. Is it Microsoft or is it Google? Google's Gemini, I think. They are constantly saying they're like making these great benchmarks, but every fucking time I go try to use their like free one, which is the same as what we just used with ChatGPT, like it just, every time the very first response I get from it is just nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, wait. Garbage. Like, I see these videos of people talking about how they get this amazing performance from it and they get all this great output and they can do all this stuff. And I'm like, okay. But every time I fucking touch it, it's just garbage. Like, every fucking time. It's like, and I don't mean like it like it's not as good, like in some way. It's like, no, its response was entirely unrelated to what I asked, entirely partially English and mixed with some other language, and like just a complete miss in terms of like, you know, you guys need to debug some shit. I don't know, like maybe when you get it working, it's fucking great, but like, you know, it's always breaking down on the side. Yeah, like when the fuck is that?
When's that gonna happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've done a good thing here today.
Yes, we have. Good job. Go team.
All right.
So is that it? We don't have anything.
Yeah, I think so.
I guess people should write in and let us know what they think about this. Some of you have our cell phones and you'll probably just fucking text us. But do send an email. We'd love to get the emails. Please send an email. Dana would
send
appreciate it.
Send it, goddammit.
Yeah, send an email to Dana, D-A-N-A at fcvm.io.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Now for the rest of the evening, I'm going to be thinking about these 10 design principles and how exactly the Ocean Gate submarine failed on every single one of them.
Yes, got it right.
Like that submarine was basically designed on purpose to violate every one of these rules.
It's so weird. Yes.
That's one of my favorite examples of, or like case studies in design is that ridiculous contraption that killed people. So funny. Oh my god. Well, anyway, that was it. Thanks everybody.
Yeah, thanks everybody. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.